your best resource for answers to all the questions you may have about your menopause experience. Dr. Mae Seibel is an international leader in women's health and menopause and is committed to supporting women in navigating the change for a healthy, vibrant life. He's editor of My Menopause magazine in the Apple newsstand and on Google Play, and founder of Menopause Breakthrough, a five-week online course that helps women create their own personal menopause breakthrough action plan. He's the former director of Harvard Medical School's Beth Israel Hospital Division of Reproductive Medicine, director of the University of Massachusetts Medical School's Complicated Menopause Program, and editor-in-chief for the medical journal Sexuality, Reproduction, and Menopause. Each month, Dr. Seibel will answer questions submitted by his community, real questions from women and the men who love them about the challenges and the blessings of menopause. Welcome, Dr. Seibel.
Sherry, thank you so much, and thank all of you for joining both of us to talk about questions that really matter to you and that you want to try and get some insight into, because as we all know, it's really hard in the limited time in the doctor's office to get questions even asked, much less answered, and that's why we created AskDrSeibel.com. I also am excited because I think it's so important that women get empowered with the right information so they can make great choices and do things to help improve the quality of their life and the ones they love. So with that, I want to ask Sherry, if you would mind, just let's discuss the first question and let's see what we can offer and let's get started.
Awesome. We'll jump right in. Well, our first question is from Susan. She was just diagnosed with DCIS, and I'm assuming you're going to know what that is. Her mom had pancreatic cancer, her grandmother had breast cancer, and her two sisters, ovarian and colon cancer, so definitely cancer running in the family. She's 56 and postmenopausal. She's asking what she should do. How can she protect herself? She also says she's of Eastern European Jewish descent, if that might make a difference.
Well, thank you, Susan, for that question. And I'm actually quite excited to talk to you about this because this unmasks a very important bit of information. DCIS, of course, is ductal carcinoma in situ, and it means that the cancer, it's very, very early, and it's located in the ducts of the nipple of the breast, in the ducts where the milk comes out. And so this is a very important diagnosis. And I want to talk a little bit before we get to the story of what you should do. I want to talk a little bit about your family history, because your mom had pancreatic cancer, your grandmother breast cancer, and two sisters ovarian and colon cancer. Let me just tell you what's really important if you haven't done this already. You may have heard of the BRCA, or the breast cancer gene. Now, the breast cancer gene is a gene that's very common in Eastern European Jewish women, but as you may have heard from the news and other sources, Angelina Jolie also had a BRCA gene. There's a BRCA1, a BRCA2. She had the BRCA1 gene, but nevertheless, a BRCA gene. Now, this is important for a lot of reasons. Now, you have a number of cancers in your family, and people who have the BRCA gene often think that the main reason that they have to worry is for breast cancer. Now, it turns out that that's only part of the story, because the BRCA gene, particularly BRCA2, is actually, it's more common to have ovarian cancer than it is even the breast cancer. Now, this is very important. Now, the next thing is that colon cancer is also more common in women who have the BRCA gene. And the part that is really rarely talked about still today is that pancreatic cancer is 20 2 times more likely in women who have the BRCA gene. So the reason I went through this with you is your family history is just not positive only for cancer. It is highly, highly positive for people who might have the BRCA gene. Now, this can be tested for with a simple blood test, and that blood test will tell you if you do have BRCA or BRCA1 or 2, which one, and it will tell you that information. And this is important for you to know because of a lot of reasons. First of all, it has an impact on your family. If you are BRCA positive, then that means that your family, your children, have a 50% possibility of being positive. And if they are, they would be at more increased risk for these very cancers, this pancreatic cancer, colon cancer, ovarian cancer, breast cancer. And for men, it would be prostate cancer as well. So it's not just a woman thing. The second thing is it has implications for you because you already have a family member with pancreatic cancer, your mom, and now you have this breast cancer. So if you have the BRCA gene, and even if you don't with a family history of pancreatic cancer, perhaps you need to talk with your doctors about screening for pancreatic cancer because it is more likely to be found in people who have a direct first-degree relative with pancreatic cancer, and particularly more likely 1 in 3 for people who have the BRCA plus a family member with pancreatic cancer. Now, this is very important. 1 in 3 is a very important number. It's high. It's not 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100. It's 1 in 3. So this is a really, really important thing that you have raised. Now, the other thing is that when people are at risk and they have BRCA, should they have their ovaries and tubes removed, fallopian tubes removed? If you have not, and if you are BRCA positive, then this may be something important to talk about with your doctor. And the reason I say the fallopian tubes is while you would think ovarian cancer comes from the ovary, that would make logical sense. But in fact, about 70% of ovarian cancer actually starts in the fallopian tubes and the cells right next to the ovary. And so if you go in for surgery, you would want to have the fallopian tubes and the ovaries removed. And that can typically be done by laparoscopy, a belly button incision, a day surgery. And you could go home later that day or the next day in most instances, and that would virtually eliminate that risk of ovarian cancer for you, and that would be very important because that's a rough decision. That's a rough cancer, is pancreatic cancer. And also, pancreatic cancer is on the rise. By 2020, pancreatic cancer is going to exceed colon cancer as the number 2 cause of death due to cancer in the United States. Something is going on in this country that has enormously changed the demographics for pancreatic cancer. And so you want to be mindful of all of this. And, of course, your children, if you're BRCA positive, will have to be tested with this blood test. Probably it's recommended in general about age 25, and that's so that they can make decisions about childbearing and so forth. And then often surgery is done to remove women's ovaries as a prophylactic, as a prevention, and fallopian tubes. That's done sometime around age 40 or somewhere around that, usually about 10 years before the person who was diagnosed earlier with ovarian cancer got their disease, about 10 years ahead of when that disease started. So these are all questions. You have a lot of questions to sort out. Now, the question comes maybe about estrogen, and it's a complicated story. people actually, just to finish this BRCA thing, DCIS is overrepresented with BRCA, and the data is so now coming in strong enough that just having DCIS is believed now sufficient reason to have BRCA screening. So anyway, get that done. In terms of the estrogen story, women who are BRCA positive are always wondering, well, gosh, I'm worrying about breast cancer. Can I take estrogen? And the fact of the matter is that the data now shows that women who are BRCA positive and don't already have breast cancer and who take estrogen are not increasing their risk for getting breast cancer. So you're worrying about breast cancer. You got the BRCA gene. You're worried. And you think, I can't take estrogen because it could increase my risk of breast cancer. That's not what the data shows. It does not do that. But you have DCIS, and this becomes a decision that I would need to know more about to counsel you. But you have to talk with your doctor about treatments, about options for you. And so the question is, are you a candidate for estrogen? That is something you're going to have to discuss with your doctor to talk about in more detail. But there are a lot of treatment options for the symptoms of menopause that have to do with alternatives to estrogen, depending on what your symptoms are. So there are so many ways to go with this. I'm going to stop here because I don't know more details to talk to you about. I hope this has been helpful for you. Talk with your doctor about BRCA screening. If there are other questions, you can always go to AskDrSeibel.com. And I hope, too, that you'll share this with your friends because the information we talk about, but also that other people can come and ask questions that is important to them to try and help them cope with some of the issues that they are trying to deal with.
Well, that's great. I think that's great information that Susan will have when she visits her doctor, so thank you for that. So our next question is about Premarin. It's from Ginger, and she says she was prescribed Premarin after a total hysterectomy about 25 years ago. She's now 70 and is wondering if the Premarin can be discontinued.
Well, Ginger, you raise an important question. Some people are worrying about if they can start Premarin or other estrogens. And remember, Premarin is a conjugated estrogen. A conjugated estrogen is an estrogen that has multiple estrogens combined together into one estrogen, so multiple ones in one capsule or tablet. And this is not a bioidentical. Bioidentical, of course, is one that has the same chemical structure as the ones you typically make. I'm not going to talk here about which is better or not. That's another discussion. But so some people are worrying, should I start it? And then others are trying to figure, when do I stop it? Because that's a really common one, or can I stop it? So let me just comment about that. Of course you can stop it. You can stop any medication at any time, and Premarin is no exception. You're now 70. The question is, why are you stopping it, or why do you want to stop it? So the thing is this. If you were having active hot flashes at the time, and you took the estrogen because you wanted to eliminate your hot flashes, that's fine. Just realize that about 30% of women who will stop it, even though it's all these years later, may have a recurrence of their hot flashes. So hot flashes do come back even these many years later. If you're going to stop it, it's best to stop it slowly, and by that I mean have your doctor work with you and taper it off, so it could take you between 2 weeks and 2 months to actually be off of it, and then you can likely be able to stop it that way. Many of the benefits of taking hormones, helping to prevent the issues of dementia, helping to lower the risk of heart disease and so forth, have started early enough, and if continued this long, have done most of what they're going to do for that. They're going to help you have strong bones because you've been taking hormones all along. So you have to just realize that you've gotten a lot of the benefits of it, and if you stop it, there's no reason that you cannot. Just take it as a tapered dose, take it off, and you may realize that if you come off, You may have symptoms return. If you do, you can talk with your doctor about alternatives to estrogen that can be used to get you through this window, and hopefully the symptoms will stop. But there's no mandate that you're on it. It's not like an addictive drug or anything. You don't have to stay on it any longer, although there's no mandate that you have to come off of it.
Oh, great information. So here's a question I can really relate to. It's from Angela, and she wants to know why, if all of her weight loss efforts seem to be unsuccessful, she's eliminating sugar, she's cutting back on calories and exercising, and nothing seems to be working. Do you have any thoughts, Dr. Mesh?
Well, that's what one woman told me. She said she cut out smoking, she cut out drinking, she cut out men, and now she's cutting out paper dolls. So it's hard to know what to take and what to stop taking and so forth. You know, weight loss at the time of menopause is particularly challenging for women, even women who are really doing their best to stay in shape and to fight that pants getting a little bit too tight. And, you know, a woman told me the other day, I have a closet full of clothes that don't fit anymore. It's maddening. So let's just talk a little bit here in general about weight loss and menopause, because that's a whole discussion into and of itself, but let's talk about it briefly. Weight loss is very complex, but some of the things that contribute to weight loss are, number one, your choice of foods. It's not only how much you eat, but also it matters what you eat. So the more that you focus on foods that are whole foods, that are healthy, that are low in sugar, the better. So some people will eat a lot of fruit, for instance, and feel that, gosh, they're eating really healthy stuff. But in fact, a lot of fruit is still a lot of sugar. So your meals are best served by having them be about half that's mostly salads that's made out of greens and roughages and things like that, and then about a quarter that's vegetables, and about a quarter that is the protein. It could be a piece of chicken, it could be fish, it could be steak. Something should be about, you only need about 3 to 4 ounces of the protein source, the meat, and it should be about the size of a deck of cards, roughly. That's it. So number one is that. Number two, sleep is a major factor for people who have weight control issues. Sleep is not a time when nothing is happening. Sleep is a very dynamic time, just like when leaves fall off of trees. The tree is not dead sitting there. It's actively metabolizing. It's just doing different things. When you sleep, you're producing hormones such as leptin that make you inhibit your appetite. And you are also, when you run short of sleep, you start to make a hormone called ghrelin, G-H-R-E-L-I-N, that actually makes you feel hungry. So dieting and not sleeping don't go together. You will be less successful if you try to diet in the context of not sleeping. The fourth thing is stress. Most of the people I know today, whether it's in a professional level or whether it's at a personal level, are having challenges that they're dealing with. They could be personal challenges, they could be family challenges, they could be financial challenges, they could be work-related challenges. There's all kinds of challenges. And all of those things create stress, and stress creates cortisol, and cortisol is supposed to give sugar into your body and mobilize it in order to have the energy to do a fight or flight, either to take on the adversary or the as the caveman did, the saber-toothed tiger, or to run away, or to fight to the end. So given that's what it does, it's throwing a lot of sugar at you, and if you don't really need all that sugar for your body to for energy, because you're sitting around watching TV or doing other things that are less active, then it's going to put itself right in your belly. And that's where it deposits. And that fat, which is not only the fat that you can grab with your handlebars, you know, that you just grab onto, but it's fat in the lower part of, in the inside of your abdomen that surrounds your bodies is very harmful for health, and it can lead to something called metabolic syndrome, which is a condition that is leads to prediabetes. It's a condition of a, for women, a waist over 35 inches. It's a slight increase in blood pressure and a increased fasting blood sugar and an increase in unhealthy fats and a decrease in HDL or the good cholesterol. So these combinations, three or five of those together is metabolic syndrome, and it's often with people who have what's called central obesity, or you know, the so-called apple shape versus the pear shape. So cutting down stress is another important one, and of course exercise is important. The final thing I will mention for you, well, in the exercise, let me just say that part of what exercise does is, number one, it's going to burn calories, but number two, it's going to build muscles, and muscles burn three times the calories that fat does. So if you got more muscle, the same amount of food's going to get burned up quicker than if you have mostly fat. So that's why. So the final one is that estrogen is also an important factor in the story of obesity in women, because estrogen helps to make insulin more effective and to deposit more sugar from the bloodstream into the metabolism that you can actually burn and use for energy. So estrogen actually helps, and one of the outcomes of the Women's Health Initiative study that they have found, that's the big study that started in 2002, and there have been multiple studies since then, have shown that women who take estrogen were at lower risk actually for type 2 diabetes. So there's a lot of things you can be doing. There's obviously much more. And I have a free ebook called Changes During the Change, What to Expect and What to Do About It. And you can download that free by going to freemenopauseebook.com. And you can download that. It'll give you some more information about menopause and changes that occur naturally and some things you can do about them.
All right, and that's a great ebook. I would definitely recommend everybody on the call to go to that and get that. Very cool. Okay, so Wendy wants to know where she can get compounded estrogen at a reasonable price. She's on Medicare right now, and Medicare won't pay for it, and she puts in parentheses, yet. She's appealing it, but in the meantime, she needs a good source because she's on a fixed income, and I just really can't afford the cost if the insurance doesn't cover it. Do you have any ideas for suggestions, Dr. Mage?
I do. Let's talk a little bit about compounded estrogen, because many women want to go to compounded estrogens because they provide bioidentical estrogens. And let's talk about what is compounded estrogens. Compounded means that you go to a pharmacy that is a compounding pharmacy. And way back in the day, pharmacists actually took herbs and antibiotics or whatever was the medication, and they weighed them out, and they actually took them and put them into little capsules, and they put those packages together for you and made your pills. And maybe they made ointments for you, or they made different hormonal conglomerates that they would take the hormones and mix them into a cream or a salve so you could use it. Today, most everything comes manufactured. It comes to a compounding pharmacy. And so they don't, to all pharmacies, actually, for that matter. And you don't have to have a pharmacist who typically actually puts the medicines together into pills, capsules, gels, or whatever you're getting. But that's where the compounding came from. Today, about the only thing that compounding pharmacies do, or the most important things that they do, the most distinguishing things they do, is that if you want to have a hormone, they will actually take the hormone and they will put it into some type of a medium. It may be a cream, it may be a lozenge, it could be anything, and then you will put that cream on your skin, and that's then the hormone is absorbed with the cream as it melts into your skin. So that's typically what compounding pharmacies do, and women usually want it because it has the estradiol. estradiol, which is the most common one, or it has estriol, which is a very rare in women that they don't make it except during pregnancy, or estrone, E1, they call it, which is a weaker estrogen. So there are many compounding pharmacies that put one, two, or three of these together into a cream. Now, the good part about compounding pharmacies, because the second thing they do is they can make it up in the exact amount. So say you wanted a certain amount, maybe you wanted, instead of 50 milligrams, you wanted 60 milligrams, just making up that number. They could just put a little bit more into the same capsule or into the same cream, and you could get it personalized for you. So that's the second thing that they do that's particularly unique. Whereas in most stores, when you go to the drugstore, whether it's Walgreens or Rite Aid or Duane Reade or any of the ones, Eckers, any of them, CVS, you end up with what's the stock and whatever is the standard dosing. So there's a distinction there. But the downside of it is that when you go, you're paying for them to put that into the cream and so forth, and it's more expensive, and it's often not covered by insurance. And I will say that there's some data now that says that just like when you go to the ice cream store and you want to get your chocolate chips and your vanilla ice cream, when you stir up the chocolate chips into the vanilla ice cream, sometimes when you scoop it out, you're going to get a mouthful of chocolate chips, and sometimes you're going to get just one chip or no chip in it, because you know it's pretty hard to stir something up into a mix that's evenly distributed. So even though you get it filled properly at compounding drugstores, and they give you what the doctor asked for, you may not receive what the doctor ordered. You may get more or less. And there are a number of studies where prescriptions were ordered, gotten, and then sent off to analysis, and that's what they find. So you have to be aware of that possibility. Now, here's the good news about it. Most of the time you go to the drugstore, it's for the compounding pharmacies to make you an estrogen or a progesterone, sometimes testosterone. Those are common ones in women's health. And you want these bioidentical hormones. Well, if you go to any of those drugstore chains that I mentioned before, they too sell bioidentical hormones, and they sell them in the form of pills, patches, sprays, gels, and creams. Same kind of thing. They are available in the drugstore, the standard chain store drugstores. And here's the nice thing about it is that insurance, and I would think Medicare is also going to cover it, will cover hormones that are from the traditional stores. And those are FDA regulated, and so they are standardized as far as dose and how much you get. So to answer your question simply and succinctly here, if you're going and it won't cover it at the compounding drugstore, you can get the same estrogen at the traditional chain store. Just get your doctor to write for a prescription for one of the patches or pills, which is what most women take, that is standard in the pharmacy. And because they're now generic in most of them, it will be covered by Medicare, and then you won't have to have the battling that goes on to get it approved by the pharmacist. So, by the insurance, by Medicare. So consider doing that and see if you can't get it with a lot less strain, and probably you will be able to.
Oh, that's great. Great idea to get it and not have to go through all the hoops for Medicare. That sounds like a good plan. Okay, our last question today is from Katie. And recently, Katie's doctor took her off estrogen replacement after she was on it for 10 years. She's only been off for 2 weeks now and is already experiencing hot flashes, chills, and difficulty sleeping. She says, help.
Well, Katie, some of what we talked about earlier is some of what you're asking about now, and that is when you come off of it, what do you do? First of all, the data on coming off of estrogen and when is not 100% written in stone. So do you have to come off after 10 years? Well, there are some doctors that believe that it's probably a good idea to do, although it hasn't been 100% demonstrated that it's absolutely necessary. Now, you haven't told me if you were on estrogen only or estrogen plus a progestin or progesterone, so there's some nuance in that that I can't and therefore won't address here. But I will say that if you do come off and you're having those symptoms, and symptoms recurring are pretty common, at least 30% of women do, come off of the estrogen slowly, and to do that, since you've already come off, you may have to go back on it and then come off of it in a tapered way over a period of weeks or months to minimize these symptoms. But if you don't want to go back and recreate this wheel that you've already gone through and live through that month again that's been challenging for you, then talk to your doctor about alternative approaches to the symptoms. You may be able to get something for sleep that can help you. You may be able to get alternatives for hot flashes. There are a variety of things that you can do and should look into. Now, one of the things to keep in mind on is that when you do come off of estrogen, if you've been on it through the beginning of your transition into menopause and you've been on it for 10 years, there's always the chance that there's going to be more bone loss at this point in time. So you want to get a bone density, or talk to your doctor about getting a bone density if you haven't had one, and make sure that your bones are solid now, see where you are, and then you may want to follow that up again in 1 year or 2 years to see the level of bone loss, or if that's a problem. And you want to get on supplements for calcium and vitamin D and a multivitamin, and make sure that you're taking those things. And then consider the options for the specific symptoms that you have, such as the chills or hot flashes or difficulty sleeping and so forth, and you have to tease them apart instead of taking estrogen for all of those things, and just simply define the problem, treat it with alternative approaches, and then slowly come off of those things and see how you are in 3 months or 6 months, and then make a decision if you're happy at your current state, and if not, what can be done has to be readdressed depending on what happened over these next 3 to 6 months. But just deal with the symptoms now one at a time and follow up in terms of making sure that your bones stay strong and so forth.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, we had some great questions today. There was a little bit of a theme around the estrogen and replacement strategies. So thank you for all those amazing insights, Dr. Mesh. Anything you'd like to say for parting comments for today?
Well, the main thing I'd like to say is thank you for sharing your questions and for allowing other people to hear your questions, because really and truly so many people are struggling with the same things. And the reason that we created AskDrSeibel.com was because we know that in the 8 minutes you get in a typical office visit, it is very hard to get your questions answered. I do hope that you will share the site with your friends, people who might benefit. It's open to everyone, and we will be answering these questions. Typically, we answer them on the third Thursday of the month, each month, and it's usually done at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific time, and it's a forum for you to be able to ask the questions you either don't have time to ask, maybe embarrassed to ask, or just curious and want to know and haven't got an appointment coming up for a long time. So it's an opportunity to find out. And also, by listening to other people's questions, it's an opportunity for you to learn from other women's experiences and to find out that there are many people sharing the same things, and sometimes we feel very isolated. You can also follow me on Facebook at My Menopause Magazine, and you can also follow on Twitter on My Menopause Mag, and both of those places we're always putting out information for you. And I offered earlier, if you'd like, an ebook that you can get some specific information on changes during the change, go to freemenopauseebook.com and download the book. You get instant access to it. And in April of 2016, I will be having a new book. My latest book will be coming out from Rodale. It's called The Estrogen Window. And in that book, I'm going to be sharing breakthrough information on when to take estrogen safely, when is the best time to take it for the least amount of risk, and things that you can do to optimize the experience of menopause, particularly as it relates to hormone therapy. The Estrogen Window from Rodale, and it'll be out April of 2016. So I hope you will be on the lookout for that book as well. So that's most that I have to say.
Perfect. Great resources. Well, I've enjoyed today, and I look forward to our next interview on July 16th, as you said, at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And in the meantime, thank you so much for your insights and education and amazing support, Dr. Seibel. I know everyone appreciates it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for all your help, Sherry.
Okay, we'll see everybody next time.